Morning, counsel.
Morning, Chief Judge Santel, members of the panel of the court. My name is Robert Becker, and I represent Mr. Burwell. Please, the court. After going through its five-factor analysis in Castillo, the Supreme Court's final words were, these considerations make this a stronger separate crime case than either Jones or Almendarez-Torres, cases in which we were closely divided as to Congress's likely intent. For the reasons stated, we believe that Congress intended the firearm type related words it used in 924C to refer to an element of a separate aggravated crime. The court was unanimous in Castillo on that point. In O'Brien, its final words were, the analysis and holding of Castillo apply to this case. What that really means is there are three crimes defined in 924C. There's the base offense, and there are two aggravated offense, of which the base offense is a lesser included offense. As the court would read the words of the statute in Castillo, it would substitute the word short-barreled rifle or shotgun in the B1 offense, and it would substitute the word machine gun in the B2 offense for the word firearm in the A1 offense. And viewed that way, two things are critical here. One is that the presumption of mens rea applies from the beginning of the sentence to the end. And an example of how to view this is a device that Judge Tatel used in Villanueva Sotelo, in which he said the statute can easily be written a different way to make it clear. And the way that statute could be written is to say that whoever uses or carries a machine gun during and in relation to any crime of violence or drug trafficking crime shall, in addition to the punishments provided by such crime, be sentenced to imprisonment for 30 years. That makes it very clear that what Congress was intending was to define a separate crime, and that even if you parse out the sentence, the mens rea element would apply. To reach a contrary result, the government relies heavily on Apprendi in an attempt to obliterate a distinction between facts that are truly offense elements, as the Supreme Court said weapon type is in Castillo and O'Brien, and facts which can bring about serious sentence enhancements. It is noteworthy that the Supreme Court, when it decided O'Brien, referred to Apprendi.
Can I just interrupt?
Yes, sir.
When you say there's an easier way to write the statute, as the statute is now written, it says, if the firearm possessed by a person convicted of a violation of this subsection is a machine gun, it doesn't say anything about anybody's intention that it be a machine gun. It just says is. That's a state of being. I guess I'm finding it hard to figure out how Congress could have written this more clearly than that without a sentence that says intent is irrelevant, which Congress doesn't usually say.
Judge Garland,
intent with respect to the machine gun, obviously, yeah. Not intent with respect to the rest of the violation.
I think, Judge Garland, that what happened is, and the government filed a 28J letter earlier this week with some of the legislative history of the amendments to the Firearms Owners Protection Act. It's clear from the statements of Congress that they understood the presumption of mens rea applied to 924C. In other words, that a 924C violation, it must be knowing. The question is, what must be known by the defendant?
And that's not indicated in the legislative history, what must be knowing.
That is not at all, as to 924C, it is not indicated, except that it's clear from the statements made by the congressman that they intended a knowing standard to apply, and what they were trying to do in 1986 was to make sure that a willingness requirement was not applied to 924C.
Quite apart from legislative history, doesn't Dean tell us that when the passive voice is used, that it suggests that Congress does not require proof of intent? that the focus is on what happened and not so much why it happened?
Judge Griffith, Dean is interpreting 924A1, 2, and 3.
I understand, but the Chief Justice is writing about what we are to make of the use of the passive voice, just looking at the text of the statute alone.
But what the court ultimately found in Dean was that the 924C1A2 and 3 sections are sentencing factors, not sentences for the primary conduct, for a separate crime. In other words, C1A2 and 3 are in addition to
I understand that.
A1.
The point I'm getting at is I thought what Dean was telling us by its focus on the use of the, by focusing on Congress's use of the passive voice is what is Congress trying to communicate to us? And in that case, said the use of the passive voice suggests that Congress is not so much interested in what the intent of the actor is, but just what the actor did. And it seems to me that's consistent with the reading that Judge Garland just offered up for you to comment on.
I think the problem here is, again, that the actor may, one of the things that happens here is there's a choice that a defendant or a person who commits a crime makes.
Right.
Okay, so it's not just a circumstance of the crime. It's a choice that's made about what weapon will be carried. And to fulfill the deterrent purpose of this statute, the increased sentence, there has to be some, as Justice
Sotomayor. Might there not be another deterrent purpose of the statute? And that is that there's an inherent danger when someone walks into a bank with a machine gun. And it's a danger of a different type than if they walk into a bank with a pistol. They're both dangerous. One is far more dangerous for bystanders than is the other. Why isn't that the deterrent effect?
Well, certainly the 30-year sentence reflects the relative danger. But again, what the court said in Castillo is we're looking at three distinct crimes when it interprets the statute. The first crime is using a generic firearm, and then there are two more dangerous kinds of firearms that are encompassed within the B offenses.
So is the same true then if we hold this way? Same would be true for the drug statute, right?
No, it would not. I don't believe Judge
Garland. We've held that the three increasing provisions based on quantity and type are three offenses. So why wouldn't it apply there?
I think for two reasons. One is the structure of the statute, which is the A section of 841 sets out the offenses, and the B section sets out a series of penalties. I believe that correctly this court has held that the jury must decide quantity, certainly because that invokes a new range of sentences. So under Apprendi,
you said it's an element, just like O'Brien says it's an element here. We've said that type is also an element, just like it's an element here.
But the court has treated it differently than it would treat a true element of an offense.
We've only treated it that way in the sense we've come out opposite to the way you want to come out in this case. But other than that, we haven't treated it differently in any way.
But I think that when you look at cases like Flores-Figueroa and this court's opinion in Villanueva-Sotelo, you have to come back again to how do we read the sentence of a statute. And the Supreme Court said in Flores-Figueroa that the mens rea element applies to all elements of the offense unless Congress indicates affirmatively that it does not.
You've made a big distinction between elements of the offense and sentencing factors. You say Dean is a sentencing factor case, therefore the presumption doesn't apply. Why is that? Because if it's a sentencing factor, it could be just as serious an impact on the defendant. So why the divide in the presumption of mens rea between sentencing factors and elements of the offense?
Well, two reasons, Judge Kavanaugh. One is that sentencing factors tend to be things that usually were within the discretion of the judge to do. And the other thing is that usually when a sentencing factor increases a sentence, it's within the range of the sentence that was defined by the the overall offense. So at that point, the court says under Apprendi that there's no need for the jury to decide that.
So your theory is there's no presumption of mens rea for sentencing factors?
There, I think that's pretty clear.
And there is, and that's how you distinguish Dean then?
Well,
Dean, on Judge
Griffith's question. Other than Dean is a sentencing factor case, and this is a separate crime case.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What about knowingly transporting a minor across state lines for the purpose of prostitution? You have to know it's a minor.
There are a couple of statutes like that. There are several statutes like that. And the reason is Congress has indicated a special intent to protect minors that militates in against applying the standard presumption. Sex crimes were generally at common law. The presumption of applying intent to every element was not at common law required in sex crimes.
And using a juvenile to commit a drug trafficking offense, the purpose was certainly not to protect the juvenile there.
Well, I think the Supreme Court has said that yes, it was, because there was an interest in protecting juveniles against being brought into the drug trade by adults.
What case was that?
I'm sorry, I can't off the top of my head tell you, but.
What about theft of federal property over $1,000 versus under $1,000? Bank theft over $1,000.
Bank theft, okay.
Under $1,000. 10 years for over, 1 year for under.
Judge, I have not read the legislative history of that statute. The government cited several statutes, and we went through each one of the ones they cited and looked at why it came out that way. And in most of the cases, it's because either Congress had a different reason for not applying mens rea. For example, in the case of the federal officer, it wanted to provide a federal forum.
Right, I understand the jurisdictional cases. That's why I'm trying to ask you about the ones that aren't jurisdictional.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the statute, so it's very difficult to interpret why that happened.
Do you abandon the approach that the federal public defender took in its brief in support of petition for rehearing in bank, focusing on the moral culpability and how that is reflected in the statute?
No, Judge Rogers, we don't. I believe what we're saying is I think that in the opinion in O'Brien, the court said that the reason that there's this, that one of the, that the reason this statute is there, that the 30-year sentence is there, is because the court views this as a higher degree of moral depravity, is I guess the phrase that was used in the opinion, that when you choose to bring a machine gun to a crime. And so, no, we're not abandoning that. But I would like to come back to something in the Gilliam case. Judge Rogers, I think, as I read the case, said that the rationale under Harris and the other pre-O'Brien cases was that because weapon type was a sentencing factor, special mens rea applied. I think the converse of that is when it is an element of the offense, then the same analysis as that in Staples comes into play, and the requirement of a special mens rea element is...
Well, at least in that case, the court took the position that Staples was focusing on innocent, protecting people otherwise engaged in innocent conduct.
Correct, but in making the distinction between why, as to why Staples didn't apply to 924C, you drew the distinction appeared to be that because it's a sentencing factor, the special mens rea element doesn't apply. And I think that's the reasoning that the First Circuit in Rivera, which is subsequent to O'Brien, says that the First Circuit has now, this is dicta, but it says the First Circuit's position now is that mens rea does apply.
There are lots of sentencing factors where intent matters. The fact that you obstruct justice gets you extra points but only if you intended to obstruct justice, not if you accidentally obstructed justice. And you could say similarly here that the judge should have to decide, did you intend to bring a machine gun? And similarly, you could say that the judge should have to decide, in the Dean case, did you intend to fire the machine gun?
But the distinction is already made in the statute, in that the Congress included C4 to make sure, make clear that there is a mens rea requirement as to brandishing. Okay? Because there was a fear, I believe, that if when they put the when they broadened the scope of C to include carrying, use, possession, they were afraid that if a witness saw a gun in the belt of a person committing a crime, that they that person would be sentenced to the 7 years for brandishing merely because the gun was seen, I think. And so because it understood that there is no presumption of mens rea as to a sentencing factor, it included C4, which specifically requires mens rea as to the A2 offense.
Can I ask you one hypothetical? Guy walks into a bank carrying a machine gun, robs the bank, walks out and is arrested, does not testify, and that's all the evidence. He can't be convicted of this intent to possess a machine gun, can he?
I think he can if, okay.
I've given you all the facts.
Excuse me?
I've given you all the facts.
You've given me all the facts,
right.
But you didn't tell me whether he bought the gun.
That's right.
Whether it's police, his gun.
That's
given
right.
You all the facts. We're fighting the hypothetical and answering it, please, counsel.
I guess I couldn't have said that better.
I think he can if it's plain on the face of the weapon, if he knows.
Putting ifs in there.
Yeah. It's an AK-47 with a selector switch.
Okay.
Just like in this case.
At no case is as pristine as that, but I think because there's circumstantial evidence that can be, that the government could present, and the circumstantial evidence might go to his knowledge of guns.
Already ruled that out. This is all the evidence.
That's all the evidence.
The gun looks just like the one here.
What I'm asking is, that would be speculation.
Why
if we decided to put let that go to the jury, wouldn't that be stretching our rules about what gets to go to the jury?
I mean, the government gets to make its argument, and if I it's might come out that way, but I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that it comes out that
now,
way.
Why don't you just concede that he couldn't be convicted?
Yeah.
On that,
why don't you just concede that he couldn't be convicted on that hypothetical?
Well, if that's all the facts, I can deal with
it. Yes, and move on.
I will.
That's the consequence of your argument. That's the consequence of arguing that there is a mens rea element. That is, that some people won't be convicted, right?
It is.
So what's the matter with acknowledging that? Isn't that the logical consequence of your argument?
I think it is.
Judge Garland seems to have given you a case where that's most likely to happen.
But I guess the one caveat I would have to that, it doesn't mean he won't be convicted. He won't be convicted and sentenced to 30 years.
You're not suggesting to us that we can rule with you in confidence that everybody's going to be convicted anyway, are you?
Not under any circumstance.
Right? Okay.
But knowledge can be, as you said, inferred from circumstantial evidence, including the mere fact that you possess the weapon. That's what Staples said, right? Obviously, there are going to be more facts. As you say, it's never going to be as pristine as that. But Staples went out of its way to make clear this didn't mean you could never prove knowledge by circumstantial evidence.
And I think this case is an example of how you can prove knowledge. They had a witness who testified about the circumstances of acquiring the guns and about why they acquired them. Whether that's attributable to Mr. Burwell or not is another matter. But again, I come back to, it doesn't mean he isn't going to be convicted.
I thought your answer was it means he isn't going to be convicted.
He's not going to be convicted of the B2 offense.
Oh, yes, I see.
But he will be convicted of the A1 offense.
I understand.
So if we rule with you in this case, this would go back for retrial with the issue being submitted to the jury. This would not be a case in which we would reverse the conviction for all time, right?
I think that under the circumstances of this case, you could vacate the conviction under B, the 30-year sentence.
30-year sentence and conviction.
And impose an A1 sentence, just as you would a generic drug crime if the quantity had not
been. But this would go back for retrial. It would not be a reversal of the conviction under B2.
Oh, no, no. It would be a reversal of this count of the conviction.
You are saying it could not be retried?
I suspect that you would not want it retried just on the issue of the gun charge.
That would be the prosecution's decision. But we cannot tell them that this cannot be retried, can we? Because your claim is that the jury was improperly instructed. That's really your basic claim, isn't it?
My basic claim is both that there was not sufficient, no evidence was put in, and.
All right. So you are raising the sufficiency of the evidence as well
yes.
as the construction of the
yes.
statute? Was there not evidence that one of some of the cooperators testified we wanted a gun to go right at that to scare the police? Or?
There was.
Why wouldn't that be enough to get it to the jury?
Because in this case there were six robberies, and my client was not a participant in the robbery in which they used these weapons.
He was carrying this one, wasn't he?
He was, but he was not there either when they bought the weapons or and tested them, or during the earlier robbery when they shot at a police officer in Prince George's County.
But you would agree that at least the five-year mandatory applies, right?
I think the reality is that a 10-year mandatory applies because Chetaney said that he shot a gun in that bank.
So the proper remedy from your perspective, the government could retry or the district judge could resentence on this count but with a 10-year mandatory.
Correct, for A2.
As opposed to
A3, I'm sorry.
10-year mandatory as opposed to the 30-year mandatory.
Correct.
But the maximum's life, so the district judge could sentence as she saw fit based on the facts and circumstances within that range, right?
She could, Judge Kavanaugh, but as the Supreme Court pointed out in O'Brien, the history of this statute is that judges have tended to impose the mandatory minimum as
Let
a consecutive sentence.
Just a moment about the context. You know, Justice Stevens' separate opinion talks about how in the 70s and 80s all these statutes were passed to increase punishment. And that because they were mandatory, he suggests, they are an element of the crime, as O'Brien held. I'm surprised the government didn't put a photo of what a machine gun looks like. I'm just thinking of Congress after the period of all these shootings of public officials, looking at a machine gun such as is in effect here, and as Congressman Poff says, this is to tell these defendants to leave these guns at home. We don't care what kind of gun it is, but if we show it's a machine gun, you know, you are removed from society for, you know, 30 years, period. And we really don't care whether you consciously intended or you were just careless about bringing a machine gun. These things are such dangerous weapons.
I think Congress could do that.
So when we talk about, you know, if Congress is silent in the statute and there's a presumption, and then there's all this background about congressional activity and congressional intent, and you seem not to want to deal with that.
I will be perfectly happy to deal with it. I think that Congress has certainly known about this debate for quite a while. And as I pointed out, I think, in my reply brief, it tends to let the debate go on until the Supreme Court does something that makes it very clear that things are going in a direction different from what Congress intended.
Well, the argument might be from a congressman or the chairman of the Judiciary Committee's point of view. We were very clear in the statute. We put the word knowingly and willingly in when we intended intent. And as Judge Garland's hypotheticals and some other questions have pointed out, the passive voice, this background, all of these things suggest that Congress had no intent, even though it's a very harsh sentence, but it's a very dangerous weapon.
And as I think the Supreme Court pointed out in O'Brien, if Congress had intended that to be the case, it would have made these two pieces, B1 and 2, A4 and 5 instead, and made them sentencing factors. But it didn't do that. It made them part of a separate section, and the court was very clear that by restructuring the statute, Congress did not change its intent about how this statute should be interpreted. So I think Congress has had several opportunities and known certainly since this court decided Harris in 1992 that there is debate about how this should be interpreted, and it's had several opportunities to amend the statute, and it has not clarified the point. So I think this is a strong case. Again, Supreme Court was unanimous in saying that this statute defines three separate crimes, and so it's been very clear for a while, and Congress has chosen not to do that, and to accept the fact that it's read as with the presumption.
When you say it's been clear for a while, it's really only been clear since O'Brien, correct?
Well, that's true, but I think that it's been clear that this has been an issue of debate since 1992. It's certainly clear since O'Brien that the court has interpreted again.
Well, the statute was changed in 98, then Castillo interpreted the old version.
Correct.
We don't have a definitive interpretation of this version until O'Brien, which is recent. Before that, a lot of courts were saying this was a sentencing factor and therefore the presumption didn't apply. That all potentially changes once the Supreme Court says it's an element of the offense, correct?
That is true.
So it's relatively new, I think.
And yes, but at this point, it's going to take getting, if Congress, because
put it
Congress,
this way, do we have any cases post O'Brien from the courts of appeals one way or another?
Only a footnote in Rivas, which is the First Circuit case, which says that in O'Brien, we interpreted the statute as requiring mens rea as to this element.
Mm-hmm. So as far as the idea of a question of a photograph of a machine gun, the AK-47 here would look just the same in a photograph, whether it was semi-automatic or fully automatic.
That's correct. Yeah. And one of the assumptions the government is relying on is that one of these guns had a drum magazine.
Well, the drum mag could actually also be used on a semi-automatic.
It could be used on either. It just means there are more bullets.
Yeah.
So that doesn't say it's a machine.
Not how many times per trigger pull.
Correct.
Can I just ask you about the standard of review you're arguing for? I am a little confused about it. In your brief at page 13 where you describe the standard of review, the only argument you make is that the evidence was insufficient for any reasonable juror to conclude mens rea. And there you cite Jackson versus Virginia. That's the only standard of review set forth in your brief.
Well, it's the standard certainly for, the issue here is you can agree on the interpretation of the statute and affirm Mr. Burwell's conviction. The standard of review for whether you affirm Mr. Burwell's conviction certainly is that.
I don't see any other standard of review. I mean, the argument about instructional error, I don't see you setting forth in the brief that that's the problem here, and I don't see you citing Chapman, for example, or any of the any case that might be relevant to that standard of review. And the same in your brief before the panel. The only argument you made is that it's insufficient for any juror to conclude that it was that the person intended a machine gun.
And I think the standard that comes from the fact that that the statute has to be interpreted as requiring that element, which the government produced nothing on. Your review here is, I think, closer to the government's argument about stare decisis, which is, have O'Brien and Castillo so undermined the holding in Harris?
No, so you might say that because the judge refused to instruct on mens rea, that we cannot uphold this unless reasonable juror could not find that he didn't have the
double negative is confusing,
yes,
me, Judge
right,
Carla.
Well, no, but the government would have to prove that under any circumstance, a reasonable juror would have to find that, beyond a reasonable doubt, that there was mens rea here.
Correct.
But you don't make that argument. That would be a Chapman argument. You don't make let me put it another way. That's the harmless error argument, and you don't make that argument.
I guess my sense is that when you get to sufficiency of the evidence, harmless error is only relevant to whether how you review it in sense that you wouldn't review for plain error in a sufficiency of the evidence argument situation. So I guess I think that the standard is really not Chapman versus versus harmless plain error here.
I agree that you could make an argument about harmless error here. You asked for an instruction or not, you certainly argued mens rea below, and the judge didn't give it, and you're entitled to a harmless error standard of review here, which is the best constitutional harmless error, which maybe is the best you can get, but you didn't ask for it.
And that, I think, is because at the trial court, the defense never asked for the instruction.
So then you agree that that's... Let me see if I'm clear then. You agree then that the only question before us is whether, as you say at pages 13 to 14, whether after reviewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, any rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of a crime beyond reasonable doubt.
That's correct. With two intermediate factors, which is one is the judge prohibited the defense from making the argument based on its defense, its expert, okay? And also...
I understand. So assuming that there was evidence that you could put in more evidence, and assuming that mens rea is an element of the offense, the question is, could any reasonable trier of fact have found the essential elements of the crime beyond reasonable
doubt? That's, I think, the underlying standard of review here.
So the answer to Chief Judge Santel's question is, in your view, this is not a question of whether it goes back to the jury or not at all. This is only a question of whether you win or you lose.
On whether we win on the B2,
yes,
or we lose on the B2 and end up with the A offense.
Leaving aside the yep. A's. Yeah, that's right, isn't it?
And I think that's correct. I hate
to belabor what may turn out to be a small point, but if a judge fails to submit an essential element of a crime to a jury, isn't that something more than simply an instructional error?
Well, I mean, I think that's presumptively. If an element isn't supported by any evidence, that's presumptively.
Whoa. That wasn't at all what I asked you. Assume there is evidence to support the proposition.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge says that the proposition has been established when he gives the sentence. But the judge does not submit that essential error to the jury. Now, there's evidence. Assume there's evidence. But he doesn't submit to the jury. Do we have to then decide between reversal outright or vacating and remanding for retrial?
I think you have to...
I know this is not the way the case was argued.
Vacating outright, I'm not sure I understand the distinction you're drawing between vacating outright and not being retriable. Is that what you're saying, rather than...
Reversing outright. Reverse the verdict,
right.
The judgment on that count. It's over. It's done. The contrary, it could be that we would vacate the conviction and send it back for retrial.
I think you end up in the vacate and send back for retrial because, again, there's... the likelihood of sentencing if you vacate outright, then he's not going to be resentenced at any level in this case. And we're not arguing that. We're arguing that if you were to vacate his conviction on the B2 offense, that it would revert essentially to the A.
You just gave me two different answers. No question it could revert to the A offense. But could it also be retried on the B2 offense?
I guess the government could theoretically retry it on the B2 offense.
That's
and
what I've been
and
to
you
ask.
Also said that the 10-year mandatory, you acknowledge it, that could just be imposed.
That's correct.
Okay.
Because there is sufficient evidence presented that he carried some gun
right.
in that bank.
I think Chief Judge Santel is unquestionably correct. My question really was, did you make that argument in your brief? And I don't see it anywhere.
I think if I did not make it in the main brief, I made it in the reply brief, that it would be sent back, and that ultimately there is no situation here where there would be no conviction at all.
But did you make the argument that it could be sent back under B2?
I don't think I did not.
No.
No, I did not.
Thanks, sir.
If there are no further questions, I will.
Okay. We'll hear from the government. You've used up your time, or we've used up your time. In any event, we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal after
Thank
the
you,
government's response.
May it please the Court, Stratton Strand on behalf of the government. I'd like to begin, if I could, by dispensing with the notion that the fact of the machine gun being an element versus a sentencing factor gets us anywhere in the determination of whether a mens rea element should be implied into the statute. As this court held in Burke, although cases generally apply the presumption against strict liability to statutes that define criminal offenses, we have little doubt that it should also be applied to legal norms that define aggravating circumstances for purposes of sentencing. And as Judge Kavanaugh's question suggested, Dean itself, although acknowledging that the discharge provision was a sentencing factor, did not base its holding on the fact that it was a sentencing factor.
Well, that's how it was characterized in O'Brien.
Right.
Dean was characterized in O'Brien as being a case about sentencing factors. And that's why, and O'Brien said that it was concluding that this statute, as compared to the provision at issue in Dean, was an element of the offense. And a lot of things flow from that. One, it has to be in the indictment, it has to be charged and found by the jury, and I think the Supreme Court's case law also says that the presumption of mens rea applies to elements of the offense more strongly than it does to sentencing factors. In fact, I don't think they've applied a presumption to sentencing factors.
I don't think I made myself clear. Dean, in reaching the conclusion that the discharge provision did not contain a mens rea requirement, did not say this is a sentencing factor.
I know. O'Brien said Dean said it was based on sentencing factors.
But
I'm just talking about
Dean,
how O'Brien characterized Dean.
What, if you look at Dean's analysis, though,
yeah.
Dean's analysis is the plain language of the statute.
Did you tell the Supreme Court they were wrong about that?
You know, O'Brien's pretty clear on that in saying, because the government cited Dean to the Supreme Court in O'Brien, and the Supreme Court said, well, that doesn't control because that's a sentencing factor.
But O'Brien wasn't deciding whether mens rea should apply.
I understand that, but it was deciding whether there's an element of the offense, but that makes a big difference, I think, for whether the presumption of mens rea applies. Is it an element of the offense or is it a sentencing factor?
It's also not a foregone conclusion that mens rea must apply simply because a fact is an element. We've cited a number of statutes in our brief that specifically found that explicit mens rea requirements did not apply to certain facts defined in the crime.
Well, the Supreme Court has made clear, even with statutes that are silent about mens rea, Staples and Gypsum, a number of others, that mens rea applies. And then even where the statute only has mens rea as to one element, it applies presumptively to other elements. In fact, the argument you're making here is...
I'm sorry, I would disagree with that characterization. I don't mean to cut you off. Please finish your question.
No, you go.
I'm just excited.
Yeah, no, go ahead. You go ahead.
What the Supreme Court has instructed in Excitement Video and most recently in Carter is that the presumption of mens rea applies to each element of the statute that criminalizes otherwise innocent conduct.
Okay, that was the same exact argument. The exact argument that the government made to the Supreme Court in Flores-Figueroa.
Okay.
And, in fact, the heading, petitioner's proposed construction is not necessary to avoid criminalizing apparent innocent or otherwise lawful conduct. A whole section on that to the Supreme Court in Flores-Figueroa.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they reject it.
Well, the reason they rejected it was because of the plain language, and that is the same factor that should lead to the opposite result.
They talked about the way statutes are ordinarily interpreted, and Justice Alito's concurrence talked about the presumption that applies to each element.
Actually, Justice Alito's concurrence specifically was written to push back against the notion that there is any sort of normative rule that the word knowingly at the head of a statutory phrase will apply to each element.
He said it's fair to presume that a mens rea requirement applies to each element of the offense?
Under this statute, because of the wording of this statute, it's different local geography, Your Honor.
Right.
In Flores-Figueroa, the natural reading of the statute, which was headed up by the word knowingly, which of course does not appear in this statute, was that it applied to each of those elements as a matter of ordinary English grammar, not out of any sort of normative presumption that mens rea immediately applies, necessarily applies to each element. And the court has repeatedly stated that the presumption of mens rea only applies if Congress has not indicated a contrary intent. And of course here we believe there are many strong textual reasons to conclude that Congress has indicated a contrary intent. And B, that in the absence of congressional indicated intent, it would still only apply to those elements that criminalize otherwise innocent conduct.
Just interrupt you there. Yeah. You used the word only, and that's in your brief on page 24 as well, in a quote from Excitement Video.
Yes,
if you look at Excitement Video, the word only is not there. You've added the word only where the Supreme Court has not used the word only.
If I could cite to Carter, I think Carter makes it absolutely plain and is the
most... Talking about which kind of mens rea applies, a general or specific intent, the quote there.
If I could just quote Carter... Carter states, the presumption in favor of scienter requires a court to read into a statute only the mens rea which is necessary to separate wrongful conduct from otherwise innocent conduct. We are in the not otherwise innocent conduct here. I don't think there's any dispute about that. If I could, what Flores-Figueroa focuses on is the plain language of that provision. And, of course, Dean does the same thing. It focuses on the plain language of the provision. The textual indications here are very strong that Congress intended not to apply a mens rea requirement to the machine gun provision. The first is the word doesn't appear in C1B2. The second is that it is phrased in the passive voice, which Dean found to be very, very strong support that Congress didn't intend to focus on the culpability of the actor. There is a very direct parallel to the drug crime cases where in Branham, this court interpreted 841A not to require a mens rea requirement as to drug type and quantity based on the same passive voice. 841B states that if the drug type or quantity involves passive voice is a certain type or a certain quantity, the penalties go way up. The passive voice is a very strong indicator of congressional intent not to invoke culpability. And then the third very strong textual reason to believe that Congress exempted mens rea is the disparate inclusion and exclusion that's found within Chapter 44 itself. There are three other explicit machine gun provisions, all of which contain explicit mens rea requirements. Congress is presumed to act intentionally in disparate inclusion and exclusion. Those are the textual reasons that support this conclusion. There's also a very strong purpose reason, which Judge Rogers' question suggested. Here, Congress's intent was to deter criminals from taking the most dangerous type of weapons to violent crimes. How is Congress going to do that if we engraft a mens rea requirement onto this provision? If we engraft a mens rea provision, it undermines Congress's purpose. It gives the defendant the incentive not to inform himself what this selector switch does.
Suppose hypothetical, a defendant was 100. The evidence was the defendant was 100% certain that it was not an automatic, not a machine gun. What result? Still guilty of the 30-year mandatory under your theory, right?
You can't be 100% confident.
Take the hypothetical.
Okay. Even the hypothetical, because any gun is capable of switching over to automatic firing, it would later be found that the machine gun is in fact a machine gun. Is that your question?
Yes.
Yes. He would be guilty. Why? Because anybody who takes a gun to a violent crime does in fact take the risk that it's going to turn out to be a machine gun. And that is
Congress wanted a 30-year mandatory minimum based solely on a fact that the defendant was unaware of?
Congress wanted to place the onus on the defendant to apprise himself of the nature of his weapon so that that weapon does not get brought into the bank.
That's the same argument that was made in Staples.
The argument was
that you're dealing with a dangerous device, therefore the burden should be on the defendant to show that it wasn't the kind of gun prohibited.
Very
different.
And I realized
that was the innocent conduct thing. But
exactly.
And then in Flores-Figueroa, the same argument was made again. You didn't.
The reason Flores-Figueroa rejected that argument was not on a doctrinal ground. It rejected it because it deemed that argument insufficient to overcome what it called the clarity of the text. And again, here we have clear text. Mm-hmm. And if I could, in terms of the purpose of this statute, there's also a very nice analogy, a very strong analogy to the Chin case, which is the using juveniles to commit a drug offense. And in that case, this court concluded that Congress's purpose of protecting juveniles strongly indicated that Congress would have intended to exempt the age of the minor from any sort of mens rea requirement. In other words, to put the burden of inquiry and the risk of misjudgment on the drug trafficker. The same analogy or the same statement applies to this situation.
Actually, you have a slightly stronger argument. We said in Villanueva Sotelo, the reason for the conclusion is Chin. In Chin was that it was implausible that Congress would have placed on the prosecution the often impossible burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant knew the youth he enticed was under 18. Obviously, sometimes you can prove the person is under 18. In the government's view, is it any easier to prove that the defendant knew that a person was under 18 than it is to prove that the defendant knew his gun was a machine gun?
It would be no easier. I don't see why one would be easier than the other. That was one of the grounds that Chin relied on. But Chin also said, and I agree that that's a strong argument in our favor, Chin also said, quote, the objective of protecting juveniles as a class strongly indicates that Congress meant to impose on the drug dealer the burden of inquiry and the risk of misjudgment. Now, and I understand this is a minor case, and there may be special considerations involved in the minor case. And you were about to ask a question, so I don't want to interrupt you.
No, actually, I was.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You look alike.
Yeah. Can I go back to your discussion of Staples? As I understand your argument, you're telling us that Congress must have made the judgment that there's something about the use of a machine gun that's so inherently dangerous that it justifies the strict liability regime that you're saying it creates. Am I right about that?
Not exactly.
Okay.
Not exactly.
The way we
and I believe Harris distinguished the Staples situation was that in Staples, there's a widespread background tradition of lawful ownership of firearms. And therefore, if we fail to require a mens rea requirement as to the nature of the firearm that requires it to be registered, then you would risk criminalizing apparently innocent conduct.
Right, right.
Whereas here, there's no possibility of criminalizing apparently innocent conduct. It's not innocent to go to the bank robbery in the first place, and it's certainly not innocent to take a gun to help you commit the bank robbery. So imposing a strict liability aspect to just the machine gun provision does not risk criminalizing otherwise innocent conduct. That's the distinction we see between.
But I thought the justification, you're trying to find a justification for Congress imposing such a severe penalty on the use of a machine gun, was because there's something inherently more dangerous about the use of a machine gun than another weapon that could be used in a crime.
We don't argue that this is a public welfare statute.
Okay.
And Dean did not treat it as a public welfare statute. We think that the reason that Congress exempted mens rea from the machine gun provision was to account for the risk of harm that is created, the increased risk of harm that's created by bringing a machine gun, whether you know or not, and in order to put the onus on the person who would bring the firearm to make sure that it is not a machine gun, to make sure to not allow the defendant to say, hey, look at this selector switch. It has three settings. I wonder what these are. Wait a sec. No, I'm not going to determine what it is because I want to be able to.
Would the same rule apply to B1 offenses?
Yes, Your Honor. The
would not apply. Knowledge would not be required on a short-barreled rifle, for example.
Yeah, semi-automatic. Yes, Your
Honor. B1 includes a short-barreled rifle.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Would the same rule apply that you didn't have to know it was an inch shorter than the?
Yes, Your Honor.
It would. Why would that be? I mean, you're talking about enhanced danger. A short-barreled rifle is no more dangerous than a pistol. In fact, it's not really any more dangerous than a long barrel rifle. So why would Congress not have wanted a mens rea to apply to something that is enhancedly wrong because Congress says it is without an inherent increase in danger?
The reason, again, comes back to the text and what's contained in the text. It's the passive voice. That provision, too, I believe, is phrased in the passive voice, which indicates Congress's intent to exempt it from mens rea.
Okay, I'm not going to make the grammatical quibble that I don't think that passive voice. I think that's an inactive verb, actually, but that keeps, it's been mischaracterized enough times that I won't quibble about it now.
Okay, but I would.
An English minor. If I'd been an English major, I'd probably quibble longer.
I spent time trying to figure out what's an adjectival versus an adverbial phrase, so I'm with you. I would note that with regard to the machine gun provision, Congress doesn't use the passive voice just once in this statute.
It's phrased the same way, I think, in both subsections, isn't it?
It did, and that is the same phraseology that Dean found to be indicative with regard to discharge. There's another instance in the statute where Congress again uses the passive voice with regard to the machine gun provision, and that is in C1C2. If the firearm involved is a machine gun, then mandatory life. That firearm involved is the exact same language this court in Branham considered indicative of a congressional intent to dispense with mens rea as to that element. If I could turn briefly to the, unless there are further questions about the legal issue, I had planned to turn to the sufficiency question.
Well, can you address the rule of lenity?
I happily, Your Honor. The rule of lenity, as Liperata makes states, quote, is not to be applied where to do so would conflict with implied or expressed congressional intent. And our position is that Congress has expressed its intent impliedly through the language of the statute, the passive voice, these disparate inclusion and exclusion in particular, and also through its clearly stated purpose to deter individuals from bringing weapons of this type to violent crimes.
Including the legislative history, doesn't that create an ambiguity about where knowingly extends to?
To the contrary, to the extent that the legislative history is relevant, we don't believe it directly answers the question at all, but to the extent that it is relevant, it supports Harris's interpretation of this provision. What it indicates is that Congress intended, or at least this particular senator, House of Representative member, wished to maintain existing law as to the interpretation of the basic 924C offense. And the existing law was that a general intent requirement applied only to the carrying of a firearm and not to the attendant circumstance of whether it's carried unlawfully. In other words, whether you have a permit or some other reason to lawfully carry it. Congress's intent to carry over that existing law actually supports the government's position here, which is that mens rea, Congress understood a general intent applying requirement to apply to the basic offense, but not to the attendant circumstance of the nature of the weapon.
When the Supreme Court in O'Brien, though, referred to the moral depravity of choosing the weapon as being the Congress's basis for a 30-year mandatory minimum, but if there's, how can there be moral depravity of choosing the weapon if you, as you acknowledge, could be convicted without knowing that it was a machine gun, or actually thinking to the contrary, checking and thinking to the contrary that it's not a machine gun, you're still guilty of the 30-year mandatory minimum?
We don't, Brian, of course, was addressing the separate issue of which whether the jury or the judge decides this fact, not whether it's a fact that has to be proved at all. So it's a very different analytical framework.
But in talking about why it was an element of the offense and why Congress had established a 30-year mandatory minimum, which is, you'd acknowledge 30 years as a mandatory minimum is fairly extraordinary. And the reason the court said that Congress did that was in part the moral depravity of choosing the machine gun.
Congress did refer to the moral depravity of choosing the weapon. We think it's a very big stretch to suggest that seven-word clause uttered in a different analytical context was intended to be a sub silentio ruling that mens rea was required.
Yeah, I don't think it's a ruling, but I think of the court's concern about mandatory minimums generally, including Justice Kennedy, who authored that opinion, his concern about mandatory minimums, which he's expressed many times, comes out in that opinion, and it's pretty unusual to apply a 30-year mandatory minimum based on a fact that the government says the defendant doesn't even have to know. That's fairly extraordinary.
Well, what would be extraordinary would be having the judge decide a fact like that, not providing the jury, the indictment and jury and beyond a reasonable doubt protections. And that, of course, is what O'Brien was concerned with.
He didn't have to find beyond a reasonable doubt that there was main knowledge in this
case. No. That's not a fact.
I don't understand what you just said.
I'm saying that O'Brien's concern was should we understand Congress to have wished this to be treated as a sentencing factor or as an element. And Congress said, given the severity of the sentence, we think Congress would have wanted the jury protections to apply.
Wouldn't that apply to what Judge Kavanaugh's asking you about here?
To the fact.
Would that reasoning not apply here?
To the fact of its being a machine gun. Not
the fact
to,
of his knowing that it's a machine gun.
Okay, well, first of all, O'Brien simply didn't say that, and if I could, O'Brien pointedly cautioned that it was expressing, quote, no views
right.
on the subject.
It had been conceded by the government in the lower court there.
Was there a question?
But in terms of you talk about protection of the defendant, the Supreme Court's concern about the protection of the defendant, the jury protection versus the judge protection is not much as compared to the mens rea protection. The mens rea protection distinguishes innocent of this enhanced offense from guilty or innocent from libel. That's a huge protection for the defendant. The jury is helpful, obviously, as compared to a judge, but the big one is the...
I would agree. Of course.
Right?
Mens
rea protects...
Of course. I completely agree with that. But what we come back to is the statutory text and what has Congress indicated its intent is with regard to this. And we think that the three textual reasons we've cited and Congress's purpose of preventing a person from bringing a weapon to a violent crime and trying to make darn sure that if they're going to bring a weapon, they don't bring this type of weapon, that argues very strongly that Congress intended there to be no mens rea requirement.
I'm going to belabor one more point. Even if they made darn sure that they didn't bring this type of weapon, they're still guilty under your theory of the 30-year mandatory minimum.
Look at Dean for an analogy. Okay, in Dean.
Factor. Right. But you're going to rely on it. I understand. I would too if I
heard you. Thank you, Your Honor. Dean involved a situation where the defendant brought a gun to the bank robbery, did not intend for it to go off, and actually swore and ran out of the bank when it did go off. And the court said, look, what Congress was doing here was addressing the risk of harm that you create when you bring a firearm to a bank robbery. And that's the same thing that applies here. You do take the risk, and you create a huge risk when you bring a gun to a bank robbery, and you take the risk that it's going to turn out to be a machine gun, and Congress wants you to make darn sure that it's not a machine gun before you go. And how do you do that? You put some bullets in it, and you take it to the industrial park where these guys fired these things off, and you check its function. That's very easy. Congress wanted the onus to be on the defendant to do that.
It's not that easy. I mean, that's the point of the Judge Kavanaugh's hypothetical, I thought. you think it's a semi-automatic, but you've used it enough that it wears down and it's an automatic.
Before you...
At the bank robbery.
Before you go to the bank robbery...
Just leave your gun at home, but...
Or leave your gun at home. Better yet, don't commit the crime at all.
Yeah.
And that's what Congress wanted to encourage. If I could turn briefly to, see, I've got 5 minutes left, to the sufficiency issue. We believe that any instructional claim has been waived here for the reasons that Judge Garland's questions suggest.
Waived by what?
Waived by appellant's failure to make the claim before the panel. And we've cited Keating for the proposition that you cannot raise an...
He asked for instructions?
We're not saying that it was not preserved at the trial level. We're saying he never made the claim before the panel. You can't raise a new issue for the first time before the en banc court. Keating has stated that specifically.
His panel brief does argue instructional error. He argues that the panel was improperly instructed, and he claims that knowledge is an element of the crime that requires mens rea. Now he goes on and cites the wrong standard of review.
I'm
but
sorry.
He does raise the issue, doesn't he?
I believe Your Honor is referring to the en banc briefs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm referring to the panel briefs. The briefs before the panel were, quote, the government presented no evidence from which jurors could find that Burwell was aware that the weapon he carried was an automatic. That was the opening brief. The reply brief.
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right about that.
Okay. Correct. He did not raise
right.
it before the panel.
Yeah.
And this
No,
panel,
you're correct about that. Sorry.
Okay. And this court's, the panel decision that this court issued described the issues before it as, was there sufficient evidence that he carried the AK-2 handles, and was there sufficient evidence that he knew it was an automatic weapon? That issue was not before the panel. It's inappropriate to raise it for the first time en banc, particularly because we stand here before you not having even briefed the harmless error issue. The government hasn't had the opportunity to brief that. There's a lot more we would say on that point if we had the opportunity. It's completely inappropriate to...
No, I'm not sure there's a lot more you possibly could say.
If it's
an element and it's taken away from the jury, it's an essential element, it's taken away from the jury, could it ever be harmless error?
Yes, under Nader it could be.
It could?
Yes, Nader specifically says that failing to give an element...
You would have to conclude that no reason... To do my double negative again here, you would have to find that every possible reasonable juror would conclude that he had a machine gun here. And that strikes me as pushing Nader over the edge.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court right now is considering a case called Vasquez, which is set for oral argument on March 21st. And in that case, the question is what level of certainty is required to find harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt where...
I understand that, and I think that's part of the problem with the whole argument today, which is we're being asked to predict what the Supreme Court might do in the future based on a case, O'Brien, in which the court specifically told us this case does not stand for any proposition with respect to mens rea. Now, there are different ways to interpret the roles of appellate judges. One is to count up the 9 justices and see if you can figure out, based on their past history, how they might decide. Most people think that's the wrong way to decide. The right way to decide is look at what the cases previously have said and see if they overrule, and see if they overrule our opinions, and leave it to the court to make a determination. So I wouldn't press too much on what the court might do in a case that hasn't even been argued yet.
I couldn't agree more with Your Honor's point. My only point was that we haven't had the opportunity even to brief the issue, and we don't know even what standard of review would properly be applied in a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt context. In any event, the evidence here was amply sufficient to show that Mr. Burwell knew that this weapon was an automatic weapon. The main feature was the selective fire switch. It had 3 positions, and the defense expert himself testified that that would allow a person of reasonable intelligence to determine in about 10 minutes, or I'm sorry, 10 minutes of watching TV would allow the person to determine what that was for. There were many more factors that would...
TV shows are you referring to?
Well, I don't watch TV. I only watch Dora the Explorer with my kids.
I like to watch that show. I don't think there are very many which you could make that determination based on a selector switch, which in the picture you can barely see. I appreciate that it's reasonably long, But that doesn't mean that the person could tell just because there's a switch on it.
Well, there, of course, there's the Ninth Circuit case, which Franklin, which we've cited, which does consider it quite important that there was a selector switch on that machine gun in terms of. And, but
I think that's
there,
okay for the sufficiency. I maybe should take back what I said. That's enough for sufficiency.
Yes.
It's not enough for a Nieder-like argument.
If that's all, if that was all we had, it would not be enough for a Nieder argument. Correct, Your Honor. Here we have much more than the selector switch. Here we have the fact that it was that the gun was affixed with a 75-round drum magazine. That doesn't necessarily mark the gun as an automatic weapon, but it certainly suggests that it must be capable of it. Why do you need that many bullets otherwise? And then you have the fact that this crew knowingly and purposely went out to obtain automatic weapons that went rat-tat-tat-tat-tat because they wanted to intimidate the police. And in an organization as highly put together, as highly planned as this organization, it is inconceivable that the members of that organization would not have informed their brethren when they allowed him to join them on the bank robbery what the nature of these weapons were, if only for their own safety. If you pick up an automatic weapon that you think is a semi-automatic and you pull the trigger, you're going to get a very big surprise, and you might well shoot one of your co-defendants. Because
that's
it's
so speculative.
I've never shot an automatic weapon.
I mean that his co-defendants are going to tell him, oh, by the way, it's not a semi-automatic. It's, I mean, you know, you don't even need that, do you?
Well, if I don't need it, then I don't need it, Your Honor.
That's why I thought the picture would help.
The picture is
that?
In.
No, it isn't. There's a picture of the gun, but without the magazine.
Exactly. And it
all right, but when you see it with the magazine, it's a whole other story.
And what does it look like? According to Molly Tillman, it looks like a machine gun.
But the magazine could also be used in semi-automatic fire.
Yes, but the question is,
it does not determine whether it
does
it's
not,
a gun or not.
It does not determine it, but
have a pretty tired finger if you were pulling at 75.
You would have a very tired finger.
It wouldn't be all that tired. It's not that hard.
Your Honors, I would be remiss if I sat down without noting that every court to have explicitly decided this issue has held the same way as Harris, including four other circuits. If there are no further questions.
A lot of those are based on it being a sentencing factor.
Two of them are, two of them are not, and we've cited the ones that are not.
There are no cases since O'Brien, which arguably changes the underlying principle of whether presumption applies if it's an element of the offense rather than a sentencing factor.
I would agree.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying relying too heavily on those cases post O'Brien seems to me a little much.
I don't intend to rely on them too heavily. I simply point out that there has not been a wave of contrary precedent that shows Harris to have been wrongly decided. If there are no further questions, my time is up. If I could conclude by paraphrasing Flores Figueroa, appellant has identified nothing sufficient to overcome the ordinary meaning of the words that Congress wrote, and for that reason, he has failed to carry his burden of showing that Harris was wrongly decided. For that reason, and because the evidence was sufficient in any event, we would ask that you affirm the conviction.
Thank you, counsel. We will reissue 3 minutes to the appellant for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Sentell. Let me start off by saying Molly Tillman put that two-handled gun with the drum magazine in the hands of either Morrow or Chetaney, not in the hands of Mr. Burwell. But the Supreme Court, the government made very much the same argument about not having to prove mens rea as to the hate crime statute in New Jersey. It said if you're charged or convicted of carrying the gun during a felony, then you're already guilty of a crime. You're not innocent, and therefore the government shouldn't have to prove mens rea as to the hate crime element. The Supreme Court relied on Mulaney v. Wilbur, which was a Maine case involving the interpretation of the felonious homicide statute, but it brought it back to the New Jersey hate crime statute and said that reasoning, that because he's already likely to lose his freedom and he's already been stigmatized by the fact that he's committed a crime, absolves the government of having to prove mens rea, is like saying that winship only applies to requiring proof when the facts totally exonerate the defendant. I think the Supreme Court has clearly said that less culpable defendants are entitled to the same protection as defendants who are totally innocent, that the government burden of proof is the same. As to O'Brien not addressing this issue, O'Brien couldn't address this issue. It wasn't before the court. At most, it would have been dicta if it had tried. And so it simply dealt with the issues that were presented to it. On the rule of lenity, I think under the terms of this court's holding in Villanueva Sotelo, this statute, because it doesn't say where the mens rea element falls, is ambiguous.
Can I ask that? I would have thought the government might have chosen Dean rather than Liparado as the case to cite with respect to lenity because it happens to apply directly to this statute. But the court said, rejected the argument about the rule of lenity on this very statute in Dean. Why is this section of the statute any less clear than the other section of the statute?
Again, Judge Garland, that is a sentencing factor case.
But we're talking about the words. It is a sentencing factor case. I understand that. That's what the court said. And that's what the court said in O'Brien that it said. But what I don't understand is why it's any less clear or more clear than it was before on the question of mens rea, which is the question the court rejected an argument about lenity in Dean. What words can you point to me are less clear on this than they were with respect to the discharge?
I think our position would be that the statute is clear, that mens rea is required. It is clear that mens rea applies to this element.
Well, then the rule of lenity is irrelevant.
It is. In terms of this court's decisions in the past about interpreting statutes, one of the things that Judge Tatel focused on was the fact that it was not clear where the mens rea element fell, how far into the sentence it fell, it went. And if that is the basis for deciding whether something is ambiguous, then we are in a lenity situation. I think that when the Supreme Court said in Castillo that you read the statute in the first instance as requiring the possession, use or carrying of a firearm in relation to a drug trafficking crime, and then you read the sentence again, substituting machine gun for firearm, then it really isn't ambiguous. That the statute clearly...
You're not relying on the rule of lenity.
I am relying on it to the extent that the court understands this statute is ambiguous. In other words, if you decide that this is ambiguous, then I think then the rule of lenity applies here.
Does it apply where the conduct... Now, the history of the rule of lenity, assume there's no cases. We're doing this as first impression. The history of the rule of lenity is that it's to protect someone from the risk that otherwise innocent conduct will be criminalized. Shouldn't a person who already knows he's committing a serious crime, shouldn't he bear the risk that it's an even more serious crime than he thinks it is?
I think the rule of lenity is not just to protect the innocent. The rule of lenity was intended to, when the courts have to divine what the wording of a statute is, the rule of lenity says if you have two different interpretations, you should apply the interpretation that is least damaging to the defendant in that case. It's not necessarily innocent versus not innocent of something. It is, if Congress could have had two different meanings, you apply the least onerous meaning under the rule of lenity.
Says there has to be grievous ambiguity. I mean, the Supreme Court in Dean, in discussing the rule of lenity, seems to have put the bar a little higher.
Again, it was not, it said that it wasn't ambiguous because it was.
It said the court has to conclude the statute is grievous ambiguous.
And I think if you look then at Flores-Figueroa and you look at Villanueva Sotelo, what the court said was, there are two possible readings of this statute. And in fact, in Castillo, the court said, there are two possible readings of this statute, and we are going to choose the one that requires more of the government. So that's how it got there.
Do you need the rule of lenity to win here?
Excuse me, Jeff?
Do you need the rule of lenity to win?
No, I don't think so. If, as I think the court in Castillo said, that the sentence, when you substitute machine gun for firearm, is not unclear. It does require mens rea as to every element of the offense. And that's especially true when if you reorder this, if you take that sentence and reorder it and put the machine gun at the beginning, which is a very rational, reasonable reading of the sentence, then it becomes even clearer. So,
Counsel, we've talked you past your time again, so unless my colleagues have further questions, the court will thank you for your acceptance of appointment in this case, your service to the courts and to the country. If there's no further questions, then the court will stand adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.